Welcome to Red Eyes Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and it is a pleasure to have you with us today. I'm glad that you stopped by redeyescreations.com and decided to join us as we explore some of the most fascinating and important areas of research. We are coming to you from Gothenburg in Sweden, up in Scandinavia, but you can, of course, follow us worldwide over the internet through our website. If you are new to the program, please take a look in our radio and webcast archive. We have over 1 year of radio available for free for you. Interviews with interesting people doing important research into many different subject matters. Nothing is off limits, as we are prepared to go anywhere as we search for answers. You can join us in our members area on our website and get full access to our radio archives going back to 2006. We have webcasts, films, video interviews, and much more available for you there. Again, all information is available on the website, redeyescreations.com. And today we have a real treat for you. We are going to explore the roots and possible origins of the Egyptian culture together with Robert Bouval. He's a well-known name among the alternative Egyptologists. He has co-authored books like Fingerprints of the Gods and The Talisman together with Graham Hancock. In 1999, he released Secret Chamber. Before that, he released The Message of the Sphinx. And, of course, The Orion Mystery together with Adrian Gilbert, who we had on the program not too long ago. Robert is probably best known for linking up the three pyramids at Giza with the belt stars in the constellation of Orion. But we're not going to focus too much on this aspect today. Robert is releasing a new book here in early 2010, probably towards the autumn, actually. The book is called Black Genesis, and he's hooked up with astrophysicist Thomas G. Brophy. And together they outline that the pre-pharaonic civilization possibly has evolved from a black race. Again, his website is robertbouval.co.uk. We will have this linked up on redeyescreations.com as well, so you can click through from there easily. I'm really excited to have you with us today, Robert. Thank you very much for coming on the program.
It's a pleasure. I should make a little correction. I did not co-author Fingerprints of the Gods.
You did not?
No.
Okay, I'm sorry for that.
Fingerprints of the Gods is solely by Graham Hancock. And so Hancock and I have written many books together, but not Fingerprints of the Gods.
Not that one. Okay, well, there we go. Well, at least Talisman, I know. Maybe we have time here later on in hour two. We're going to talk a little bit about Talisman, some fascinating research there. But so what we're going to do now then is basically go back, obviously, and talk about the possible origins of the Egyptian pharaonic dynasties and Egyptian civilization overall. But before we dive into some of the main material in your new book, Robert, maybe you can just let us know when you first started your research and if this Orion-Giza connection, just briefly on this, if that kind of what was spearheaded you into all of this research material, or did you have an interest in these subject matters even before this, Robert?
Well, as you may know, I was born in Egypt. And so it's not surprising that, like everybody who has had contact with the ancient Egyptian monuments, to raise some interest. I mean, but my interest was a very general interest. And indeed, I did not pursue a career in Egyptology or any related subjects. I became an engineer. I'm by profession a construction engineer. And it is only when I left Egypt in the late 60s and I settled in the UK in England, and after I qualified as an engineer in 73, I went to work in the Middle East. I spent a lot of time in the Middle East working on large construction projects. And one of my specialties was what is commonly known as setting out engineering, which is basically the engineer who draws the building plans literally on the ground. I mean, he converts the architect's plans into a set out so that the builders can align the building and align walls, etc. Mm. So I had a very, very good training in this field using instruments such as theodolites and dumpy levels and so forth. And you develop an eye for what appears to be a deliberate alignment or not. when you look at a building, or a wall, or simply an alignment. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it was in 82 that I got involved with this research in Egyptology that led to my first book, The Orion Mystery. When I saw a picture at the Cairo Museum, an overhead picture. Now, it may not seem such a big deal to people today, but I'm talking of the early 80s when there was no Google Earth and no emails and no such lovely communication instruments. And a satellite image was a kind of rarity in those days. In any case, the image was actually taken by the Egyptian Air Force in the 1950s, and it was a direct photograph of the Giza Pyramid directly overhead. And it struck me that for the first time, although I had seen these monuments many, many times, seeing them from the air, it was very obvious that what you had was two very large pyramids of almost equal size, the Pyramid of Cheops and the Pyramid of Khafra, which very clearly are aligned along a diagonal running through their apex, whereas the smaller pyramid, the third pyramid, was misaligned. It was offset to the left of this major alignment. And it's just one of those things. I usually say that I call it the apple that falls on the head, like Newton in a way.
Right.
You know, we each one of us will have an apple one of these days falling on our head. And there is only one or two people who may be tempted to ask the question, why? In the case of Newton, he asked the question, why? And we ended up sending man on the moon. And in this case, it just occurred to me that nobody had asked why these pyramids were aligned in this way, and why was the third smaller pyramid offset? And this opened an investigation, and that's how I got into it. And the result is 10 years later, I published The Orion Mystery, which I co-authored with Adrian Gilbert, you're quite correct. And there you are, that's how it started.
Fascinating, really, really interesting. And again, it is one of these things that really has opened up the whole field in a way to look at things as today in esoteric studies is kind of commonly known, you know, the simple rules of as above, so below. So many people have subsequently started to look at monuments all around, not only Egyptian civilization, but across the world pretty much, and found similar star patterns mapped and laid down, so to speak, on Earth. So it's really opened up this field, and that's just incredible. So what we can say here then is that now in your new book, you're going back, you're trying to track down the roots of Egyptian civilization and basically who built those fantastic pyramids down there. And you've hooked up with Thomas G. Brophy. Maybe you can tell us a bit how did you hook up with this guy, and how did you focus on different things together or different things apart, so to speak, and co-authored it in that way? Or how did you go about writing this book, Robert?
Well, when you introduced me, you mentioned the message of the Sphinx. The message of the Sphinx was co-authored with Graham Hancock. And in the message of the Sphinx, we expand on the Orion correlation theory and come to the conclusion that also the Sphinx is incorporated in the scheme. However, the conclusion that we arrived was that if one analyzes the astronomical qualities of the Giza necropolis, which includes the pyramids and the Sphinx, you will arrive at a startling conclusion, is that the sky image that it represents is not of the time when the pyramids were built, but of a time much earlier. And the date that came up was 10,500 BC.
Yes.
And to put it mildly, this caused an uproar with Egyptologists who were extremely upset that, in their view, there was no such event in Egypt in those dates. They hardly recognize a prehistory of Egypt. It's very rarely tackled. And therefore, although they were intrigued and baffled by the astronomical theory, their argument was that there was no evidence, there was no physical archaeological evidence to support any event that might have happened prior to about 3000 BC, when they believed the Egyptian civilization was formed. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the serious problems with this orthodox view is that many, many researchers, including Egyptologists themselves, have often been confused and baffled as to how the Egyptian civilization began.
Yes.
Simply because one finds a civilization fully formed, fully mature, at its beginning rather than at its end. The pyramids, for example, are of the 4th dynasty. Pyramid building began in the 3rd dynasty. Hardly a few hundred years after the Egyptian civilization is supposed to have started. We find a fully formed religion, a fully formed science, a fully formed astronomy, a fully formed architecture. And it simply didn't satisfy many researchers who simply could not accept that a civilization could start fully formed like that. Now, one of the theories that was quite common until not long ago was that the Egyptian civilization was a kind of offshoot of the Mesopotamian civilization, of the Sumerians.
Yes.
Simply because they had determined that the Sumerian civilization was probably slightly older. This is not the case, as a matter of fact. It has been shown that both civilizations were perhaps of similar dates. However, recently, I'm talking like the last 30 years, this theory was slowly falling apart, because clearly there was a prehistory to Egypt which was found within Egypt itself. The studies of Egyptian prehistory started perhaps with Flinders Petrie, Sir Flinders Petrie, who found in Upper Egypt, in Hierakonpolis, one of the sites in Abydos, a evidence of a culture that did not resemble at all the old kingdom of Egypt, where the at the time of the pyramid builders, everything was different. The arts, the architecture, the burials. And so he at first thought that there had been a completely different race of people that had established themselves in the Nile Valley as well. And this led to the so-called invasion theory, that it was assumed that some people invaded Egypt and settled there. However, slowly they began to realize that this was not the case, and that the evidence that they were finding was in fact Egyptian, but it was prehistoric. And slowly, many scholars began to look more carefully at this. And they concluded that in fact there had been a fairly long period of prehistory predating the foundation of the Egyptian civilization, or rather the dynastic period, as they call it. Now, in the last, the area that I'm focusing on, which is the most promising area, is the Egyptian Sahara. And I should perhaps start properly by telling you that it started rather strangely. It was well known that throughout the Sahara, not just in Egypt, but in Libya and beyond, there is much evidence of a prehistoric culture. This is rather obvious. When you travel in the Sahara, you find prehistoric stone tools all over the place. And of course, rock art.
You were just mentioning rock art, and then you were cut off.
So the Sahara is filled with evidence of prehistoric people. Now, in 1974, a group of anthropologists, led by the anthropologist from America, Fred Wendorf, who's now retired, and had formed what still is. Expedition with the Polish Academy of Science. While they were driving their cars throughout the southern part of Egypt, where the temple of Abu Simbel is, I don't know if you can visualize, the most extreme part of Egypt along the Nile is Abu Simbel. And then you have the Sudanese border that runs along the southern part of Egypt. They were somewhere about 100 kilometers west of Abu Simbel. And they stopped to have a pee. I mean, they stopped their cars, and as they were there having their comfort break, as they call it, they noticed a lot of prehistoric implements, stone tools, and but what was strange about what they were noticing was a whole bunch of clusters of stones, which clearly had been moved by human hands. To cut a long story short, what they had discovered is known today as the Napta Playa ceremonial complex. And carbon dating has dated this site to about 6,000 to 7,000 BC. So it's a very, very ancient site. However, what this site showed to them was something very, very different than the other sites that they had been investigating. Clearly, this was not just a settlement. It was a place where there was various rituals and ceremony that took place.
Anyway, we just cut off and you were just beginning to describe this the Napta Playa and the ceremonial site and a little bit about the culture that you... Or that rather these discoverers, explorers, pretty much stumble upon, right?
I was about to describe what is at Napta Playa. So let me start here. What you've got there in this so-called ceremonial site is a whole range of megalithic constructions. There is a group of tumuli, looking a bit like sort of flattened Eskimo igloos, if you can imagine them. And they were at first thought to be tombs. There's about 10, 12 of these. When they excavated them, they had a bit of a surprise because in some of them, they found the bones of cows. And in others, even more surprising, they found... no cows or human remains, but an extremely large boulder, a large stone, about 2-3 tons, that was buried, literally buried, under the ground. And they were totally baffled, and more so, the stone that was buried had apparently been fashioned, had been sculpted. And they just couldn't understand what it is. We still don't understand. But clearly, it had some sort of religious or ceremonial function. That's one. The other, perhaps more striking, was a stone circle, a sort of mini Stonehenge. It looks like a kind of mini, very mini Stonehenge. It's about 4 meters in diameter. And this now has been understood to be a calendar, a solar calendar. I'll explain in a minute, but basically it has alignments to do with the solstices and the meridian and so forth. Then there were the so-called complex structures. They're clusters of stone set in strange oval shapes. And from one of them, the main one, the largest, there were lines of stones, very large stones, like menhirs, you know, like the standing stones.
Yes.
That were placed in very long alignments, about 500 to 600 meters long. Some were going towards the north, and some were going towards the eastern horizon. And to cut a long story short, when they were investigated, many, many years later, by the way, it took them a long time to figure out that they had astronomical qualities. But when they were finally investigated by an astronomer, a man called Tim Melville, who is from Boulder, Colorado, he found that the stone circle had solar alignments, hence why they called it a calendar circle. But he found that these strange long lines of stones that shot off from the complex structure a bit like the spokes of a bicycle wheel, if you can imagine, sort of rays of stones shooting out. Mm-hmm. He found out that these, going towards the north, pointed to the Big Dipper, which immediately rang a bell, because we know that the ancient Egyptians were very, very fond of this constellation. Religiously, they imagined to be the place where the souls would go, and they indeed aligned their own monuments to this constellation. We know that for a fact. Mm-hmm. I'll explain that in a minute. However, the eastern lines were even more interesting, because he discovered that they were pointing to Orion's belt and the star Sirius, which of course immediately drew attention to people like myself, who knew very well that these stars had been used for alignments and rituals by the ancient Egyptians. So here it was. I mean, people in the desert, thousands of years before the construction of pyramids, were building strange structures in stone and aligning them to the very stars that later the ancient Egyptians used. And on top of that, they had developed a calendar. So the attributes that we had previously allocated to the ancient Egyptians, such as the calendar, for example, and astronomy, now had to be allocated to a people who were only 100 kilometers away from the Nile and had been doing this for thousands of years before. So that's the big question. The other thing I should add is that the stellar alignments that I've mentioned at Napta Playa were not only merely pointing to the stars in question, but they seem to have been tracking the stars over vast periods of time. Because, for example, with the alignment of Orion's belt, there are two alignments, one pointing to Orion's belt at a certain date. The earliest date is about 7000 BC. And then another alignment pointing to about 3500 BC or so. So it looks like these people were not only there for a very, very long time, but they were actually tracking the stars. And this completely changed the picture of what we imagine prehistoric people to do, because not only Napta Playa, by the way, is the oldest astronomical site in the world, but here we had what looked like evidence that they were actually following the movement of the stars caused by the precessional displacement. This had never been seen anywhere else on the planet. So, you know, clearly, whoever they were very clever astronomers.
This is really interesting, Robert, and there's two things I want to ask you right away. Does the people here of the Napta Playa, have them been given a name yet? And maybe you can talk a little bit about, again, this issue of dating. How the heck do you go about dating a site like this?
Well, the anthropologists had no problem dating it, because they found various organic materials buried, like the cows, for example. And they could carbon date all this. And they clearly arrived, you know, and convinced themselves, no problem at all, with radiocarbon, that we were talking about a site that was at least 7000 BC, in, you know, give or take a couple of hundred years. What is interesting is that the carbon dating could be followed throughout the millennia, and the last date that appears at Napta Playa is about 3400 BC. Now, this is very interesting, because we know that these areas became super arid. They became unlivable because of the lack of water. And the date coincides beautifully with the rise of the Egyptian civilization 100 kilometers away. So when we put two and two together, it would appear that these people from Napta Playa, when they had to abandon the Sahara, moved to the Nile and took along with them this cargo of knowledge, the knowledge of domestication of cattle, which again seems to be the oldest in the world that we have there, and the knowledge of astronomy, the knowledge of stone building and so forth, and arrived happily in the Nile Valley and injected this knowledge, which gave the impetus to the pharaonic civilization. It's very, very clear, and many anthropologists, in fact many Egyptologists, are now very seriously looking at this. However, who were these people? You're absolutely right. You know, what do we call them? And that's where it gets very, very interesting. Because at Napta Playa, they did not find any human remains. And even though it's clear that the people who were there lived there for thousands of years. So it looks like they were using the Napta Playa as a kind of gathering place to perform these rituals and ceremonies across the millennia. A bit like Stonehenge, if you like, which was not a kind of settlement. Rather, it was a place where people gathered to do their rituals and ceremonies.
Yes.
So where were these people? Well, the first sign was that they found a cemetery, a prehistoric cemetery, about 20 kilometers from Napta Playa. And clearly, they found some of the bodies of these people. There was about 67 tombs. And what comes out of that is fascinating, because there is no doubt at all from the anthropological analysis that the people were of black African origins. Now, this can be clearly determined by the size of the bones and so forth. However, they also found some bones that belonged to a Mediterranean race. And that's very, very interesting, because how the heck did these Mediterranean people, whoever they were, make their way all the way to Napta Playa, which is 900 kilometers from the Mediterranean shore?
Yeah.
So these are questions that are not answered yet. But there is no doubt that the Napta, let's call them the Naptians, if you like, were of black African origins. Now, where did they come from? And this brings us to an amazing set of discoveries that occurred very, very recently. But the story begins in the 1920s. I don't know, do we have time to go through that?
We do, but I just want to ask you one thing before we do that. This isn't in any way related to what is known as the Nabataeans, right? Which is
No, nothing to do with the Nabataeans.
Okay.
No. I'm calling the Naptans. Okay, let's just... I prefer to call them the star people, you know, because that's what they were doing. They were watching the stars and aligning things to stars.
Yeah.
And indeed, the reason they were doing that was that we know now that they were moving for a long time before they actually settled in Napta Playa. Because the evidence that we have from Napta Playa is that they came there about 10,000 BC, but would only stay there for a few months. And then they would go away. We don't know where they would go. Mm. And come back every year. Now, they would come back around the end of the month of July. The reason being is that they would come when the Napta Playa basin was full of water. Now, let me explain that in prehistoric times and about when the ice age, the last ice age, broke down, the monsoons in Central Africa would reach that part of Egypt. Now, they don't do anymore. They haven't been doing this for the last 5,000 years. But in those distant epochs, the rains would come at about the summer solstice time, would drench the Sahara, would fill up the depressions and create temporary lakes. Now, what would happen is that these people had to move from lake to lake, depending which lake contained the water longest, and they had to move vast distances. In order to do that, they had to navigate, and therefore they quickly realized that by using the stars, they could know where they were going, but they also had to time their arrival to the lakes to make sure that when they got there, that the lakes were full of water. And therefore, they also used the star to develop calendars. In fact, that's what calendars are. They're simply the translation of stellar observations and solar observations. So for thousands of years, these people had learned how to observe stars and study them. And of course, they focused on Orion and Sirius, because these were not just the brightest of the stars, but they also happened to mark the time of the monsoon. Which, incidentally, the monsoon causes the Nile flood. This is why the ancient Egyptians also used these stars.
Yes.
So, there you are. I mean, really, the best name for them is the star people, because that's what they were.
Yes. And so, Robert, One question I have here that obviously arises is how they get this knowledge, because to me, at least in one way, it doesn't matter where we move it on the Earth or even how far back, the knowledge of stellar, solar, and lunar observations, as you call it, and navigating according to them still seems to just spring up out of nowhere. Or do you have another explanation for why these people, the star people or the Nabda people, just got this knowledge? How did that happen?
Well, I mean, it's not very complicated. I mean, anthropologists are all in agreement that cultures develop and cultures learn because of the pressure that is put on them. You know, it's a bit like a child. You know, if you don't tell him to do his homework, he won't do it. Now, these people were obliged, literally obliged, to learn how to survive. And the only way to survive was to be able to move vast distances in search of water and search of pasture. They were also obliged to domesticate cattle because they probably were hunter-gatherers in their original, very ancient state. But when they had to move around, they had to actually carry their cattle with them. And the best way to carry cattle is to domesticate it.
Yes.
So these are the kind of climatic conditions that forced people, a bit like in the land where you live, you know, that's why they developed warm clothes and all sorts of things.
That's right.
So why do people observe stars? Well, in the countries where obviously they needed to either be able to time the events of the year, like for agricultural reasons and so forth, or in the case of the of the Sahara people, they had to move around. Like for example, when men started to navigate, I mean, they were literally forced to work out that if they followed the direction of stars, setting stars or rising stars, they would know where they were going.
Yes.
But it took a long, long time to be able to navigate with what also was necessary to determine longitude was timekeeping devices. Now, on the land, you don't need watches. What you need is to be able to know what time of the year it is and to be able to measure your distance physically. On sea, it's very difficult because you need to be able to time the travel that is taken from one place to the other. Whereas on land, you can actually count the distance. So, you know, here we have a situation where these people learned how to, I think the best term is they learned how to navigate. They
yes.
were navigating on a sea of sand, if you like.
Yes.
And that's why they developed it. But what is surprising to all of us is that they developed this very, very early and much, much earlier than the pharaohs. And clearly, all the knowledge that they developed later on is visible in the pharaonic civilization. So the truth of the matter is that this knowledge was imported. Now, it's no offense to the Egyptians because it was imported from the Egyptian Sahara. So I don't see why there is a problem, a cultural problem there.
Mm-hmm.
What is or might be the problem is that the star people were clearly of black origins. Now, how do we know that? Apart from the bone analysis, which does give results, but it's, you know, it doesn't tell us of their skin color. It simply tells us that they were Africans. Where we know for sure is from a discovery that was made 600 kilometers further west of Nabta Playa. And now I should perhaps describe geographically what we're looking at here, because if you look at a map of Egypt and you look at the extreme southwest of Egypt,
mm-hmm.
along the Sudanese border and the Libyan border, you will find that there is two regions there, one called Gilf Kibir and the other one called Jebel Uwainat.
Mm-hmm.
These are mountain regions. They're huge massifs that literally come out of the desert like giant icebergs.
And Robert, I can just mention here as well that you sent me a picture, a page dump of this particular map, and I'm going to link up this on the website as well so people can take a look at this map while you're talking about this.
Yes, indeed. Why not? Well, let me describe this zone. First of all, let me say that as amazing as it may seem, this zone was not discovered until the 1920s. And the reason being is that it's extremely remote. It's impossible to travel there from the Nile without a vast supply of water to make the trip and the return trip. Mm. And without the ability to carry that vast supply of water, you just can't do it. Now, we know that in ancient times, especially in pharaonic times, they even did not have the camel. So we know that for a fact that they used the donkey to travel in those kind of areas. Mm. There is no way that a donkey can carry the amount of water necessary to undergo this trip. We're talking about 700 kilometers of arid desert, which is 1,500 kilometers return. A simple calculation shows you that it's impossible. The only way to do it, well, the way we do it today is we go with four-wheel drives and we have no problem. But the only way to do it in ancient times was to create water stations, very much like one would have fuel stations if you're going to drive, say, from from London to Edinburgh. There is no normal car that can carry the amount of fuel. So you will need a fuel station somewhere along the line in order to refuel. Mm. And this was the mystery for a long time, and all Egyptologists were convinced, therefore, that the Egyptians never traveled those kind of distance simply because they just couldn't carry the water. Mm. Until everything changed a few years ago, when a German explorer, a man called Carlo Bergmann, discovered what is now known as the Abu Balas Trail. Now, let me explain what it is. He discovered a series of stations, very ancient stations. There's two main stations. Now, if you can imagine a line from the last oasis, the most western oasis of Egypt, which is Dakhla Oasis, it is at the heart of the Egyptian Sahara, and going southwest, you will travel for about 500 kilometers to reach the Gilf el-Kibir. The Gilf el-Kibir was discovered in 1926 by Prince Kamal al-Din. It is there, by the way, some of your listeners may remember, where the film The English Patient was shot. Mm-hmm. This is where Lady Clifton dies in the cave, the famous cave of swimmers.
Wow.
Now, the line that you can draw from Dakhla Oasis, 500 kilometers southwest to reach Gilf el-Kibir, Carlo Bergmann discovered about 25 little stations and two major stations. And at each of these stations, particularly the main stations, they contained a large number of pots, clay pots, that were obviously used by whoever traveled as stations. They would fill those stations, those pots of water, and when there was a caravan trail or a donkey trail, they would find, therefore, water along the way and refuel. So this is how they did it. Now, it is a fact that they traveled all the way to Gilf el-Kibir, and we know that this was done in the times of the Old Kingdom. What wasn't clear at all is where did they go beyond? Now, there is no water at Gilf el-Kibir.
Okay.
Now, Gilf el-Kibir, you've got to imagine it. It's the size of Switzerland. I mean, it's a mountain range.
Oh, really?
The size of, but if you can imagine Switzerland without any water or trees, that's Gilf el-Kibir.
Hmm.
Now, as far as we know, there is no wells, there is no water, and therefore, you know, clearly they had to go somewhere where there was water.
Yes.
And there is water beyond Gilf el-Kibir to Jebel Uweinat. Uweinat does have water pools, some rainwater that is collected and fills up certain pools. But there was no evidence of ancient Egyptians there. What there was evidence, plenty of it, was of a prehistoric people. And this was known since 1920. There was full of caves with rock art. And clearly the people who were there were rather sophisticated. They're shown with their cattle, taking their cattle to water. They have houses. They They perform rituals. They seem to have a very good time. They all seem to be playing and dancing. And there is no doubt at all that they're black. We can see from the drawings that they're very tall, very slender. They were probably the ancestors of what we call today the Tebu. Mm-hmm. The Tebu used to roam the Sahara. They still do, by the way, and you'll find them in various oases like Kufra and in Libya. Now, these Tebu, the ancestral Tebus, came from the Tibesti Mountains further southwest. Very, very mysterious mountains, also that contains an enormous amount of rock art. And clearly, that's where they came from. There's no doubt about that at all. Probably around 20 or 30,000 BC, they descended from these areas, in the Chad, by the way, the Tibestis are in the Chad.
Wow.
And they roamed the Sahara and settled in places like Uwainat and Gilfi Kibir, which at the time were very, very fertile because of the different climate. There is no doubt of that, because on the drawings that we see in those places, not only you see those black people performing all sorts of activities, but you also see drawings where they draw lions and ostriches and rhinoceros and giraffes, clearly the kind of fauna that can only exist today thousands of kilometers further south.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So there's no doubt about this at all. Now, what has been discovered very recently by a friend of mine, and that's why I went there. I was in those areas in April last year, by the way. I organized an expedition with Tom Brophy, and we actually drove from Dakhla to Gilfil Kibir and Uwainat. I can tell you, it's no Sunday trip.
I can imagine, huh?
Oh yes.
And so, very hot, I can imagine as well. Very hot and very dry.
Well, you have to choose the time of year. We went in April, which is hot, but not intolerable.
Okay, yeah.
And it took us 5 days in the open desert. I mean, we're navigating the open desert to reach from Dakhla to reach Gilfil Kibir and Uwainat.
Yeah.
You know, and I can tell you, after you've traveled 5 days in the open desert, you feel like you've gone to the moon. And it does look like it, by the way. I mean, the area is very, very strange and alien.
Yes.
And you feel like you're on a different planet.
Huh.
And totally uninhabited. I mean, it's a very strange feeling. What makes it even stranger is that you're surrounded by all these strange prehistoric rock art. And it's all a very, very mysterious place. In any case, the reason I went there is because a friend of mine, an Egyptian called Mahmoud Marai, was exploring the area with a colleague of his, a fellow called Mark Borda, a Maltese man, whom I knew as well. Mm-hmm. I had met many, many years ago. And they were at Uwainat, where there was no evidence at all until then of Egyptian pharaonic presence. But they came across, by pure luck, as all these things happen, a large boulder on the south side of the Jebel Uwainat with pharaonic inscriptions.
Oh, really?
And that completely changed the whole vision that we had about pharaonic Egypt. I mean, there was no doubt at all now that the pharaohs of the old kingdom had made contact with these, whoever they were, these star people, these prehistoric people. And in fact, in the inscriptions, they give us an amazing sign. Until then, there has been huge, huge puzzlement among Egyptologists as to the mention of a lost kingdom called Yam. We know that the ancient Egyptians traded with Yam, the kingdom of Yam, but nobody knew where it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was assumed to have been somewhere in the Sudan along the Nile. But here, on these inscriptions at Uwainat, it is made clear that the pharaohs were trading and meeting the people of Yam in the distant southwest, 700 kilometers away from the Nile. Now, where was Yam? Because it seems that Uwainat, this strange rock massif that stands there,
yeah,
was not the place where these people lived was a place where they met the pharaohs, like an envoy. They would come down from the distant Tibesti mountains and link up with a envoy from the pharaohs to trade. Hmm. And that's what the inscriptions say, that they meet the people of Yam. So it looks like this mysterious ancient kingdom was somewhere in the Chad. And that's where everything starts. If that theory is correct, and it looks like it is because of the evidence, then the origins of the ancient Egyptians was from there. It was a black African origins. What is even more interesting now is that the ancient Egyptians met their own ancestors. Hmm. They were going to actually go and see them in Jebel Uweinat.
Yeah.
So now let me tell you.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add a little bit of pepper and salt to all this, because here is the strangest of things, is that in the Bible, there is a mention of the people of Ham. The people of Ham are the descendants of the son of Noah. One of the sons of Noah was called Ham.
Yes.
And according to the Bible, it is Ham who populated with his children Central Africa. So there's a little slightly hop from the word Ham to Yam.
Yes. How do you spell Yam, by the way?
Well, in ancient Egyptian, it's the letter that forms a Y or I. Mm. And M, and so it's the best way to pronounce it is like Yam.
Yeah. You know? Okay, gotcha.
Whereas in Semitic, it's either Ham or Chem with a guttural sound.
Yes.
And I'm getting more and more convinced that, as strange as it may seem, it looks like the Bible was right, and that we have a original people. From what we know for a fact, I mean, it's been known since Louis Leary found the famous prehistoric skulls in the Rift Valley. I mean, we all come from Central Africa. I mean, there's no doubt about that at all. And we all come from a black African origins. And the reason we're white is not because we're a different human beings, is because our pigmentation has changed. The melatonin in our skin has slowly disappeared, and although it's still in the black races, because we don't need to be black. You know, we live in colder climates. So, you know, there's nothing new about this. What is new is that they are the originators of civilization, whereas it was denied to them for a long, long time. I mean, we simply ignored the possibility of an African civilization, although we knew there was some civilization that had sprung, but no Egyptologist or anthropologist, certainly of the previous century, would even claim that there was a genesis in the African civilization. We always assume that our Western civilization is from Greece, and Greece got it from somewhere else, but definitely not from Africa.
Right. So, I mean, is there evidence for any kind of agriculture as well, same as we have in Sumeria, parts of Syria, northern Iran, and so forth? It is, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, these people who, I suppose, well, the anthropologists call them prehistoric pastoralists. The reason being, or if you like, the exact term is sub-Saharan prehistoric pastoralists. Hmm. Sub-Saharan are black people. I mean, no doubt about that. Pastoralists, yes, they had cattle, they moved around with cattle, and they had to feed the cattle. And they took them to graze in pastures, but we know that they collected grains, they collected various seeds. And there is the evidence of a rudiment agriculture, because when you go to Naptaplai, for example, you see many large bowls that were obviously grinding bowls for seeds. So, yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is that the evidence is piling up literally every day that we have a very sophisticated and very ancient black African culture from the sub-Sahara that settled in the Egyptian Sahara for thousands of years. developed cattle taming, they developed the rudiments of agriculture, they learned astronomy, and then they were forced, because of the climatic change, to go at the Nile in the south at around 3,500 BC, and this, where lo and behold, we see the pharaonic civilization beginning.
Yes, like so many other people probably would have to do as well around this time period. There's been multiple, you know, cataclysms and things that has happened on the Earth climatically, which means that people have to move around all the time. And one thing I want to ask you about here, maybe we can round the first hour up on this note, is a little bit more on the calendar circle that you found, and also the cow, what's known as the cow stone. Maybe you can just mention how big are these approximately? Are these huge stones as we see in other places around the world, or are they a little bit smaller? Tell us about it.
Yes. Well, let me say outset that the calendar circle is the stones that are about a meter high, maybe a bit less.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. They're nowhere near like Stonehenge. What is very strange about these kind of sites in the desert, let me tell you, is that they seem to have been done like yesterday. And the reason being is that it's literally like being on the moon. There is no movement. There is no humidity. And if you drop something in the desert, you can go there a few hundred years later and you'll find it exactly the way you dropped it.
Yeah, that's right.
And unscathed. I mean, this is the very strange thing about the desert. I mean, we found stone tool implements that were literally lying on the sand, and they looked as shiny as they had been made there yesterday.
And there's no big sandstorms that are slowly eroding.
There are. But it's in reverse, if you like, because there are sandstorms that blow and cover things with sand, and then there are winds that blow and take the sand away.
Yeah,
so
that's
it's
right.
Kind of tit for tat.
That's right.
Where things get covered is when the dunes move. So there is now a new idea that we may indeed find many vestiges under the dunes. So the dunes move like a tsunami wave, but they move very, very slowly.
Very
but they
slowly,
actually move.
Yes.
So there you are. I mean, now, as far as the other constructions at Nabta Playa, I've sent you a picture, I think. There are very large megalithic constructions, huge boulders, about 6 to 7 tons, maybe more, that have been moved and piled up in very strange formations. There's no doubt that they not only have been moved by human hands, but they were actually, some of them have been actually molded, if you like. They've been shaped a bit and rounded and so forth.
Oh.
Now, these blocks were carried over hundreds of meters. And it's a mystery to us not only how they did it, but why they would do it. And the only explanation we all come, which is probably the correct one, is that they had a religion. They had some sort of ceremonial reasons for that, a bit like the ancient Egyptians, a bit like Stonehenge. And one must get into the frame of mind of the prehistoric people. And this is one of the most difficult things to do. You know, we live in a world where we don't think in those terms anymore, but prehistoric people were very, very close and very integrated to their natural surroundings. I mean, they believed themselves correctly to be part of nature.
Yes.
And therefore, to them, you know, what seems to us like futile exercise, like carrying stones and moving them around, to them, it was a kind of gratitude, if you like, to make that kind of effort in order to connect with the celestial gods that they believed were there. So one has to get into that frame of mind, is that to us it may seem sort of a bit silly to carry stones and put them in alignment and waste a lot of time. But to them, it was very, very important. And therefore, clearly, they had developed not only a reverence for their surroundings. I mean, one of the things that is very, very, very interesting and very, very important for us to observe,
yes,
is that they did not harm their environment. I mean, this is one of the most incredible things about prehistoric people. You will not see any damage to the environment. You know, when you go to Gilfil Kebir and those places, you will see rock art. I mean, they were very artistic, but they don't damage the environment.
Mm.
They had tremendous respect because they depended entirely on their environment to survive. So to them, even their cattle, I mean, one of the strange things about their cattle is that they rarely killed their animals. They would drink the milk, they would drink the blood like the Maasai do today.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
They even went to the whole trouble of burying them, you know, in very large ceremonial graves. So
yes.
We're dealing with people that really believed, not just, you know, voted for the Green Party, but they generally believed that they were themselves responsible for nature.
Right,
and,
right.
And that is a very, very important message that they have to teach us, because when you go in those areas, you're humbled. You think, my God, I mean, it's like the planet has just been born, you know, it's untouched.
Absolutely. Robert, let's begin here to round things up with the first hour. I have definitely more questions in regarding to the Nabta Plain and the people there that I want to ask you, and then maybe as well in the second hour we can move a little bit towards into the area of Talisman as well, this book you co-authored with Graham Hancock. But again, let us know when you expect the book to be out, Black Genesis, and how people would can find more information about the book right now.
Well, they can find information on my website, and it's www.robertboval.co.uk. Don't go to .com because somebody has hijacked my older site and it's not mine at all now. So it's .co.uk. You will find, if you go on the book section, there's a nice little YouTube that my webmaster has made that explains Black Genesis. Black Genesis is in the process of being written, as I explained, and it will be ready for publication around the early part of next year, and will probably be in the bookshelves around end of summer or beginning of autumn of 2010. So that's the rough schedule. I'm giving many, many talks on Black Genesis already, and I've done a documentary for a television channel in Italy, and probably another one will be made for an American channel.
There you go.
So, yeah, basically, it's you know, one of the interesting things about Black Genesis is that not only it exposes and brings evidence to understand our origins of civilization, but it has a strange message in that, like I was saying earlier, it explores the mentality of prehistoric people. I mean, you know, we speak of history all the time, but we forget that history is just a word, and that there were people before history. And these people were even more interesting because they really were very, very close to nature to such a degree that sometimes we're baffled at their capacity to exist in the most of difficult conditions. And we've forgotten this, and I think it's a reminder that we are very robust, that we're very ingenious, but we need to re-establish our reverence for nature. It's the only way that this planet will survive. So that's what Black Genesis tries to do as well. Anyway, go on.
Yes, okay, very, very good. Excellent. Thank you, Robert. Again, the website is robertboval.co.uk. We will have this linked up on Red House Creations. We will take a short break here, but we'll continue talking more now in the member section. So stay with us, Robert. We'll be right back. That's our first hour with Robert Boval. We will continue with hour two for Red Eyes members. We have a very interesting continuation of our discussion as we talk about the roots of architecture, Saqqara in Egypt and the Megalithic era, when people started building with much bigger stones. We talk about the ancient people and their relationship to nature, and that much architecture, temples and even pyramids are modeled after natural features in our environment. We go into climate change, human origins, ice ages, and the prehistory before history. And we elaborate a little bit on the possibility that we've been seeded from elsewhere. We talk a little bit about the idea about life on Mars, the mysterious monuments on Mars, and ask if they're natural features or created by someone. We discuss scientific research, alternative research, and keeping a balanced viewpoint. And we round things up talking about solar alignments and ancient knowledge of astronomy. RedIceCreations.com is the website. We bring you radio, webcasts, films, and video interviews. The members on our website get full access to it all. Check it out. Subscribe for 3 months. Get instant access to all of this and support an independent truth-seeking radio program that brings you fascinating research on topics that we consider to be the most interesting. You can see upcoming guests on our website. Pop into the member section and fire away a question to any of them or suggest a guest or a topic. Cue music and we'll be right back.
Everything turns, turns, turns. There is a season.